Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. We have yet another sunny day. It's not as warm as it should be. It's about 65 degrees. Today we're going to talk about Gnostics or Gnosticism and the return of what I think is that belief system. And I think it is, because I think it's returning, because I see people doing it, and they're unaware of the word that associates with what they're doing, it's probably good to call it out, define it, go through a little bit of the history of it, and then talk about how you can turn it on and enhance it, even if it's on. So what's a Gnostic and what's Gnosticism? Well, I'm going to warn you that I guarantee you that Gnostics existed in the Egyptian times without that word associated with it. The Greeks were the first people to really write down the belief system of Gnosticism. And then when the Christians came around, they were trying to usurp all things, right? All knowledge, all things. And so they've rewritten it and recast the previous generations to look like they were blasphemous, because that's what they do, right? They build their entire fabric of their church out of complete lies and deception, at least in the era of which it began. Today, no one knows what these folks are, these Gnostics, if there's even a single person who truly claims to be one. In the most general terms, a Gnostic is a person who finds a way to filter out the noise of society, quiet their mind, and simply listen to the truth, simply listen to the algorithms around them, to observe, to move without haste, to be patient, to get as much knowledge as one can in the traditional arts of science, and then to apply them to reality. What's the difference? Well, the difference is that folks that feel, folks that have gone to a lot of college and received a lot of pieces of paper from people that have never joined society, that have never had to really get a job interview, getting pieces of paper from folks that haven't experienced life, well, they have a false sense of security about their knowledge of the universe. And even though they have a few parlor tricks up their hand in terms of cause and effect, in the end, they know about surgeries, but they can't perform them. They don't even know if the surgeries they learned are real or not, because they've never tried it. But a Gnostic is a person that has usually amazing street cred, and they haven't had the luxury of formal education or indoctrination. And so they've had to listen to the universe. They've had to see what works and what doesn't work. Try things out. There are no limits in the minds of a Gnostic. But there's nothing but limits of your typical academia. It's taught to you. For a Gnostic physicist, you ask them about the speed of light and they'll say, sure. We're working on designs right now to go the speed of light, to exceed the speed of light, no problem. You talk to someone with a PhD, well, they just immediately stop and say, well, Einstein said we can't go that fast. We're not even trying. But it all goes back, way, way back to the beginning of time when man needed knowledge, but there were no libraries of Alexandria, right? They didn't exist. There were no books. You know, the mud tablets of the Sumerians were some of the first supposed written down records. But now we know, you know, carbon dating doesn't work on mud tablets. And so you'd have to push them back nearly 100,000 years to make those mud tablets make sense, while the Egyptians are over here carving perfectly symmetrical pie-oriented, you know, sculptures of the pharaoh's face, potentially 40,000 years before Christ, before the story of his existence. So what would be the biological pattern of a person without a library who needs to know something to survive? Well, let's take yourself. We put you in a desert. You have no books. You have resources around you. You can see some wood. There's some fruit. There's a stream with some fish in it. So right away, as an adult, you don't really worry about your life ending. You just go, well, I guess I got to learn how to fish. Let's eat these fruits for now. Oh my God, that's sweet. You know, I don't know how to, you know, cut down a tree, but we're going to figure it out. I've seen this, people tie rocks to the end of a stick and swing it. It's like an axe. We'll figure this out. Maybe I just have to swing rocks with my hands for a little while. But once you get yourself secure, the beauty about it is you start to think a little bit. You got some time to yourself. The predators come around. Hey, you just climb up the tree. It's no big deal. Whatever. You lock yourself in your own cage. And if you were out there in the middle of the desert, something beautiful would happen. The very mathematics, the very formulas of the universe would start to flow through you. Probably were flowing through you the entire time, but you didn't need their answers at the time. So in terms of, you know, the catcher's mitt to catch the answer, you didn't realize you were a catcher. You know, someone could throw softballs at you or baseballs at you every single day, every minute of the day. And as long as they don't hit you in the head, you'll never know that it came at you. But if you turned around with a catcher's mitt and saw all these pitches coming at you, you could catch one or two. And it's a little piece of knowledge and you could open it up, you know, look inside. A lot of folks who are researching conspiracies in general, you're looking for knowledge, looking and looking and looking and trying to associate things together. What's interesting about that journey, and I've mentioned it several times on the show, is that you will learn information A and box A, then you might learn C and everything that's in C, and then B and then D. And what's interesting about it is later in life, as you just keep thinking about your boxes that you built up randomly, and you're always throwing things in each one of the boxes, right? And like for me, it was the decade of the 19s, so the 1900s and the teens, right? And then it was the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and I kept putting things in the box and trying to figure it out. And then eventually it all clicked together as to how they are all related. And then I found out that I was the last one to the party. The historians who really kept their eyes open documented exactly the way I had put it together, but I pulled it out of the universe. I pulled it out of my own mind to look at the history of what was going on there. And what's happening is I think that we are finding a way, even in this infinitely noisy world, we're finding a way to filter out that noise and listen. Now, some of you are blessed to live up in the hills, and so you live in pure consciousness. I mean, you don't have wireless routers and cell phones that are that powerful. Most things are wired to the ground. You have landlines. I have an uncle who has a cabin way out in the middle of the woods in Kansas, and he owns 2,500 acres around the cabin. When I go out there, it doesn't even matter what I'm doing. I feel my brain breathing a sigh of relief from all the cell phone towers and all the broadcasting, wireless routers in my own house, my cell phones, all that stuff. It's beautiful. I think that what makes one a Gnostic is the perpetual exercise of asking a question and having no other place to get the answer than the universe itself. You know, if you thought you could look it up on Wikipedia or someone's website, or you could go into an old bookstore, that's where you would go. But what's interesting, the unbelievable balance of the universe is that, you know, a lot of us are pretty frustrated that there's things that are hidden, right? Hidden societies, hidden agendas, and you don't exactly know why anything is occurring. But the funny thing about that is that as long as the question is present, as long as the group of people asking the question gets a little larger and a little larger and a little larger, you don't have to know them, you don't have to be close to them, but the overall frequency, the query to this database of the universe always comes back as this question. There's a secret society. We do not know what they are doing. We want to know what they're doing, and so we itch for it. And it would seem that this sort of this ethereal wind, which may carry the truth with it, carry the algorithms of the universe, it has no choice but to go through the secret and straight into your head. And you start to get an inkling. You start to get a little bud of what you think they're doing. It's very powerful. So this is why this episode's being made, is to get you guys heightened to the mechanism, because I'm willing to bet that if you're watching this show, if you slipped into it, maybe not. If you watch this show fairly regularly, I think you're a Gnostic. And again, it's the original definition, which is essentially folks that looked at nature, looked at the world, looked at the universe, looked at humanity, and simply find the truth through feeling it. It just comes out of the universe, and you feel it. You still have to sort it out. You still have to approach, you know, appropriate it here. You need to discuss it with words. For those of you who are super existentialist, you know, you've gone through the argument that you are part of the universe. And when you're a part of something, it's hard to observe it from afar. Some people go as far as to say you can't. Because in a way, you are part of the truth that you seek. And therefore, if you're inside, you can't get an outer perspective. The best you could do is try to find a mirror in the sky to look back at yourself, right? Now, I'm going to throw one at you that's a little out there, but I think you'll understand what I'm saying here. Now, you know that we underestimate the brain constantly. We underestimate the soul, the mind, all this kind of stuff. And then we see people that don't underestimate their brains and miraculous things occur. Mentally, spiritually, sometimes physically. Now, let's say that I bring out a little paperback book and I hand it to you. We're in this setting right here. It's a little warmer than it is today. I give it to you and I say, you know, read the first page there if you could. Just read it to yourself. And it's not an electric surface. It's not a screen. It's not flickering at you at 60 frames a second. It's a book. It has pulp that's turned into paper. It has ink to disturb the photons that are bouncing off the page to go into your head. What is the process that's occurring? Your brain has a proprietary system in your brain called phonetics. It's based on a 26-letter alphabet if you speak English. You were trying to ascertain through pattern recognition, looking down at the words, the photons are bouncing off of the ink. The ink is absorbing or reflecting off the paper, absorbing into the ink, reflecting out the paper. That creates patterns in your retina, gets all rasterized inside the brain, and becomes a word. You sound it out, right? Because we used to read hieroglyphs back in the day. All you need to do is have the first letter and the last letter together, and the rest can be jumbled up in the center, and the brain can read it perfectly. And that's because that's the way that we used to write our words and hieroglyphs. That's the process for reading. How does it work? Well, you read the upper left to the lower right, flip the page. Upper left, lower right, upper left, flip the page. And that's the way you absorb information. If you're listening to what the words are saying in your mind, you're painting a picture of reality in your brain, which is actually pretty damn amazing. If I give you a fictional book by Stephen King, one of his better books 35 years ago, you read it and you actually have him painting fiction into your brain. But for the moment of the suspension of disbelief, you regard them as facts. Just for a little bit. Okay. Pretty powerful little mechanism. The printing press was amazing. It's another way of doing what I'm doing now, talking to you. What is the difference? Because we're really talking about the frequencies of those words going into your brain. That's what's happening. You're just going through some steps. You know, hold it in your hand, look down at it, stare at it, rasterize the frequencies, put them in your brain, think it through, blah, 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 right? Well, what would be the difference of turning on a light to your left and holding the page between the light and your head? You're going to have photons go through all the ink. The ink's going to go into your head. I mean, the difference of the ink not being there is going to go into your head. And of course, the back side and the front side is going to combine together. Perhaps one side's a little stronger than the other side. Maybe not. The frequency of that knowledge is going into your head. It is a much more complex shape. It's a much more complex template. What if you held the whole book up between the light and you? Some of those photons will actually make it completely through the book. Maybe it's not photons. Maybe it's ether. And maybe there's a way for you to ingest a book just by being in its presence. So I know that sounds a little bit nuts. A bunch of ether winds going through the ink of a book, and somehow you distinguishing each word, each page. But now let me take it up another notch. Your perception is that you need every single word out of the book to understand what is in the book. That is your perception. That is the way it works if you do engage in individual word consumption. But it could be that the book itself, created by a single mind or a collection of like minds, is actually creating an overall ball of frequency that within its bowels contains a knowledge of the intent of the book itself, right? Your perception is you need every individual atom to understand what an orange is. Well, you know that's not true. There's trillions of atoms in an orange, and you're completely fine with it just being an orange. It's important to understand this flow of logic, because I've never heard it spoken anywhere else, because it's going to get at the very foundation of what Gnosticism might actually be on a scientific level. There's this weird moment in your life when you mature to a point where you realize that the universe itself has around you constantly an almost an infinitely dense, packed, inconceivable container. All the mathematics that hold the whole place together. All the code, all the logic, everything. It is infinitely around you at all times. For if it wasn't, whatever principle that is missing would simply fail. You know, if gravity wasn't in a 10-foot sphere in front of me, well, that furniture on the patio there would just float off into the sky. Or at least float out of the bubble and hit the ground. We don't see any of those anomalies at all. Everything is perfect and everything is consistent. Whether or not we understand what we're looking at, that's completely different. Different question. So for those who look at this concept of Gnosticism and they say, well, it's impossible just to sit there in a chair and deduce things. Okay. I haven't heard anyone say that, so I'm not saying those people are out there. But if you're inclined to entertain that idea, let's look at this. Isaac Newton had created calculus by the age of 19. For any of you who've ever dabbled in calculus as an adult or young adult, you will undoubtedly have found it a little bit challenging, if not impossible, to figure out the first pass. And yet this kid just sat there and thought, and wrote down what he thought, and advanced that thought. Of course, he did have the principles of mathematics up to that point in his mind, but in the end, we know that he created a beautiful addition to a pre-existing system. And the thing is that it already existed in the universe. He just plucked it out for our generation, you know, our generation of species on this planet. Was able to record it in a way that we could all remember it. Now, for me, I'm sure that some Egyptians had figured it out as well. They definitely figured out pi before the Greeks. They just didn't call it pi. But they built big temples to pi, and they're called the pyramids. The sculptures. So let's go this way. You don't really have any definitive moments in your life where you felt like you dragged some knowledge out of the universe, but I just explained something to you, and that I've piqued your curiosity, and you want to see if you can do this. Well, there's a lot of different ways we can approach it. One, you're going to have to acknowledge that you are surrounded by noise on a level that man was never meant to endure. Remember, the Earth's maximum natural hertz are 32, and that's during a lightning storm. I'm willing to bet in a natural setting, the Earth's hertz are probably around 5. 3 to 5 for a normal human being. And I mean 3 to 5. Not 3,000. Not 3 million. Not 3 billion. But 3. But the cell phone towers and the communications in our homes that range from easily 32 million to 32 billion hertz frequencies of electricity that are flying through our brains, flying into our DNA, boiling our mitochondria from a cell phone. It's trying to find an antenna in a bad situation. So that's your first hurdle, is trying to reduce the amount of frequency around you, or to at least understand that if you're going to try to do it in a very densely communication-bound area, you're going to have to biologically filter out all the noise. You know, and who knows, based on your cranium, based on your proximity, how much of that actually touches the electrical charges in your brain. It could be that it goes right through you. I mentioned several times on the show crystals. Crystals and rocks in general, but definitely crystals. Crystals are the real deal in terms of absorbing random frequencies and turning them into one frequency. The piezo effect, right? It's very real. You know, we always tell you not to watch television. And part of that's to obviously not be indoctrinated by the content coming out of the television, but a lot of it just has to do with the emissions from the TV itself. The way it makes you feel. But your first goal is to quiet your surroundings to the best of your ability, because you're going to be listening to what's left. If you could take a vacation out somewhere, or you're within driving distance of a place that's quiet, really, where reception's horrible, go there. A lot of the homes in Laguna Hills down here in Orange County, they're built like bunkers. They have foot and a half thick walls with sand in them, and cinder blocks, and all kinds of stuff. They cannot send a signal around the wall. You have to put four or five routers in these homes just to remotely give each room a sense of communication. It really is it's sort of a catch-22 for the residents, because they like not having that chatter around their brains, but at the same time, they do want to check their cell phone in their bedrooms. So they know what's going on. They built their homes that way, and they were smart about it. I want to put a digression in here, as I'm talking to my friend Miguel, and we're talking about homeless people who talk to themselves. And of course, the easy way out is to say, okay, well, they're just going crazy. They talk to themselves, a psychologist might suggest, and say, they don't have anyone else to talk to. And the human mind needs the social interaction, as I've said several times on the show. And so they talk to themselves. Probably a lot of truth to that. But on the other side, imagine sitting with yourself all day long, not having anyone to talk to. And you start hearing the frequencies coming in from phone calls. You're hearing voices. Who knows? It is interesting that regardless of your origin, your age, the homeless people around the world experience the very same thing. They almost always break and start to talk to themselves if they can't find a little clan to hang out with that they can trust in the middle of the night. But it might just be that someone can hear the noise and make sense out of it. Don't be so sure, things are impossible. A lot of times, as a further digression, a lot of times people think that things are impossible simply because they underestimate their minds. They underestimate humanity. They've been taught and indoctrinated to underestimate humanity. How many children, you know, 200 years ago were brilliant? They did all kinds of, you know, Mozart writing his first symphony at the age of 7, you know. It's just because his father asked him to. Gave him the opportunity and forced him. But in the end, the kid did it. Well, if that's how much potential we have at 7, then what the hell are we doing wasting our lives until we're 18 years old? Doesn't mean you have to start paying the bills and, you know, working in the factory. It just means while you have the luxury of having your parents pay for everything for you, get off your lazy ass and get some skills. This is your destiny, man. So you quiet your environment. And then you have to do what a lot of folks don't do, I'm not, you know, this show actually is congregate, I think, the folks that do. You listen to yourself. You listen to your inner voice. And what you'll find is that the universe is actually inside you. It has no choice but to maintain you. You are built out of the rules of the universe. So if you look at your hands, you look at your palms, you look at anything you can see anywhere around you, those are the algorithms. Those are the algorithms of the universe. And you are made of it. And so, infinite intelligence, when examined, will potentially produce infinite results. And the only limitation is your inability to ask the question, really. There's a great scene in Indiana Jones 3 with Sean Connery playing Harrison Ford's father in the Jones family. And they're stuck in a tower. I've mentioned this once before. They're trying to get out of this tower. The Germans are coming up the tower. And the father sits down. He goes, you know, I find that if I just sit down and relax, the answer presents itself. And he sits down in a chair, and there's a trap door lever on one of the legs of the chair. And sure enough, a staircase appears, and they exit. But what he was really getting at is a Gnostic practice. Sitting down, quieting your mind, and just thinking. Just really, maybe even just being the radar dish, the receiver. So let's say that you do these two steps and you start having some success. Let's talk about what it's like once you get inside the Gnostic bubble of information distribution. Now, a lot of us have done it unconsciously by simply having the time to sit and listen. And things just keep coming to you and coming to you, and you're not aware of the process that's happening. And you might complete several decades. I definitely did. I completed several decades before really identifying that this is a true mechanism. You know, there's the... I'm not sure that Nostradamus ever existed, to be honest with you, but, you know, they say that he would sit and stare into a candle flame to see the future. And I thought, well, that would be a very Gnostic practice, you know, pulling it out of the universe. Oh, I wanted to, we're going to get back into what it's like when you get started here, but I wanted to preface the Christian slaughter of Gnosticism. They needed everything to be negative, right? You know, their way or the highway sort of thing. And so they thought, well, we can't tell people not to worship what's really work with them. Worked for them for the years, so we're going to demonize every deity out there and every process out there until Christianity is really the only one that looks like it's good, right? You know, they slaughtered the story of Cú Chulainn from the Irish. They everyone in South America is a bunch of, you know, baby sacrificing people. You know, even though in the Aztecs everything that was permanently recorded was always in beautiful hieroglyphs of their own, their stones, beautifully relieved, and in no passage that I'm aware of did they talk about killing their children. But of course, the Christians move in, or the Spaniards, or whatever, Christians, and there's these really bad, you know, finger painting pictures on walls, and supposedly, you know, vats full of baby skulls. See, there's proof. Don't worship what they don't, you know, you need to get rid of your religion and go with Christianity. Whatever. But when the Gnostics continued their process and didn't need Christianity to solve their problems, to enhance architecture and art and science, the Vatican essentially rebranded who they were and what their objectives were so they would be more repulsive to your nature. And immediately the one thing that they said was that Gnostics believe that God is a lesser being. Obviously, right there, anyone who loves their creator or believes in a creator is going to expel a Gnostic out of their family, expel a Gnostic out of their friendship circles. And so I'm sure there were some technicalities and belief systems that someone, you know, someone did the old Monty Python Holy Grail witch hunt skit to prove that Gnostics were somehow marginalizing the definition of God. You know, me saying that God may or may not be able to have an emotion because God is all things at all times could be construed as me saying that God's a lesser being. You know, even just saying God can't get mad, someone might say, look, he's saying that God's a lesser being. You know, get him. Right? So that's the general principle. So if you start reading about Gnostics and you start reading about this lesser God era, you're reading about the post-Christianity era of the Gnosticism movement. Okay, just so you know. So you're in. You're successfully deriving information. But now you, for the moment, you maybe you hear this episode and you're like, oh my God, that's what I'm doing. That's wild. So you start to look at the universe. And you'll kind of vacillate. And in fact, I don't want to really tell you what you're going to experience because I don't want you to experience exactly what I'm saying. I want you to have the cream of the crop experience. So I'm just telling you that you might experience phases of this. And I think it's normal. Now, the best phase is when you actually have what we call an epiphany. You're thinking and thinking, and somehow you can just see it. And a lot of people who smoke pot think they see it, and then they write it down, and they wake up the next day, and they're like, what was I thinking? But when you're fully sober, and you have an epiphany, there's nothing like it. You know, I've had one last year that hopefully I can turn into a very profitable item. But then there's the other side of it, which is your brain can get in sort of a circular loop issue with your observation of yourself and the universe. You start to get in a bit of a feedback loop. And you lose sight of what you were looking for. And you might so conceive of the universe for a split second that it feels uncomfortable for a moment. It's like being overwhelmed, like a circuit being overwhelmed with a feedback loop. And if you don't shut down the power, it's going to feedback on you and pop. Now, I've never experienced anything like that with thinking, but there's a point where you get disoriented. And that's usually when you're just exploring the idea of trying to pull something random out of the universe. You don't come in with a focus. If you come in with a focus to say, hey, man, I'm a rocket engineer and I want to solve for this one stupid problem because something is telling me, my intuition, which is derived from the same location, is telling me that this can be better, that this is a waste of energy, right? So let's talk about some people that I believe were Gnostics in the modern era. People that pulled it out of nowhere. I think Isaac Newton would be probably, even though I believe he's the 1700s, he is definitely a Gnostic who pulled out Newtonian physics, several disciplines in mathematics, and he is an icon of, you know, discovery. And we're really looking for folks that pulled a tremendous amount of knowledge into this realm that we know within their lifetime. And in ways that it was sort of a miraculous velocity, right? Having created calculus by the age of 19 is a miraculous velocity. But had he spent 50, 60 years dreaming up calculus, well, then we kind of say, well, that seems like a normal research and development project, right? Faraday, who I always mention on the show, is the grandfather of electricity. He most undoubtedly had some epiphanies about electricity, given that it's an invisible entity and he was able to come up with the way it works. But he had, you know, a laboratory, and although primitive, he had decades and decades and decades of research. So I'm not, you know, entirely point for point, decade for decade, knowledgeable about his particular life. But you move up about 40 years, and you're well within Tesla's life. And then we have a guy that almost seemed like he lived in pure Gnosticism. I mean, the guy was indoctrinated into old techniques, you know, direct current thinking. And he saw AC. He had a mind, obviously, we talked about on the show. He would design machines in his mind. Age ball bearings in his brain. And someone could say, well, that's just a obsessive compulsive disorder. being applied to a scientific outcome, and you might be right. But in the end, his string of inventions, he invented wireless communication, people. If you enjoy your wireless communication at your home or in your cell phone or whatever, in your cars, then you are 100% in debt to Tesla. Now, again, we're not quite sure whether or not Einstein ever came up with his own thing, but whoever did come up with what Einstein presented in his, what is it, 1895 paper, recertified in his 1905 papers, all of his relativity, general relativity, special relativity, and many of his other theories of gravity lenses and all this kind of stuff. You know, the tail end of his life was really just a parlor trick of, wow, if we believe in gravity, warping space, whether it be through, again, ethereal particles or his theories, which have phenomenon attached to them, he just dreamed up entities like the Einstein-Rosen bridge and all that kind of stuff. But you have a guy that can't do basic mathematics, right? He's got a guy next to him that has to do it for him. And he's just pulling amazing perception advances out of the universe. Relativity and general relativity, every kid should learn it, maybe out of the context of physics, but you know, there's a perception lesson there. I have a quantum physics book which reiterates the relativity theories at the beginning and then switches it over in the middle, but there's a great analogy of if you're standing next to a giant who's laying on his side, and the giant is a light year tall. And he moves his foot, he wiggles his toes, but you're standing at his eyes, and you're looking right at his feet. It's going to take a light year, a little under a light year, for you to see the photons that come from his feet so that you know he moved his toes. And that's interesting, because it shows you the limitations of our instant perception, because we rely on a medium that is restricted by time. It takes time for the reaction to get to you. The state change, transfer. We can't completely rely on everything that's around us to be exactly where we think it is, which affects how we associate things together. Now, one of my favorite ones, I'm going to leave towards the end here, and it's a guy named Stan Myers, and you hear me talk about him all the time, Meyers. Stan Myers invented an engine in the 90s, technically thought about it in the 80s. He's a farmer with no electrical engineering background whatsoever, but he had an epiphany. He pulled something straight out of the universe, and he thought, well, you know, hydrogen is really abundant in water, and hydrogen can be made to be very explosive. I bet there's a way to build an engine to pop the hydrogen out of water and power everything that has a piston, maybe even a turbine. And he worked for a decade to get this thing working, patented it, and then they killed him at the end because he was going to get rid of the oil industry very, very quickly. You would never put hydrogen in your car. You put tap water in the car, and it would go to your engine, and at the piston, right, where the spark plug used to be, it'd be fractured into hydrogen. Into the combination of the force of the fracturing process and igniting the hydrogen, you replace the force that needs to be on top of a piston to motor your car. Right? Well, this guy believed in angels. And I would say, why wouldn't he? Because he pulled this amazing invention right out of his ass. I mean, right out of the universe, man. He was able to build it, but it took him 10 years working really hard to essentially figure out how to build an ignition system out of a computer. Because he was hijacking the ignition system from either the computer on board your car or, you know, the old-fashioned distributor cap. But he used to sell a kit that retrofit your car to use his system. $1,500. You could just run on tap water. Supposedly, there's like, you know, a few dozen cars that had it put inside. I'd be interested to see what happened to those. So those are some individuals that I believe have wholeheartedly engaged in this process to bring us something that we revere. But now imagine if it was taught like that. Imagine if they taught you that Einstein did get it from the ethereal winds of the universe, that Tesla did it, that Newton did it, and they said, you know, if you want to get these kind of epiphanies in your life, you must go to a place where it is quiet from all this noise, all these billions of megahertz or gigahertz of data flying around the air, and go up in the mountains, do whatever you got to do, crawl in a cave, whatever it is, you have to get away from all this, go to Hawaii, and just think and go through the spiritual process of finding your balance with this process. Again, if you go in without a question, you're going to have essentially a bizarre, you know, rave with the universe. And maybe you stumble onto something that interests you. It's very difficult when you go in without a question. If you go in with a question, then it's a lot easier. Now, again, you know, if you go in to ask with a question something like, what should I do with my life? That's going to be a little more difficult, most likely. You need to understand, if you're ever asking that question, it's all about the themes of what you like to do in life, besides sit on your ass. But you go in with a problem, a mathematical problem. You'll be surprised. Now, I'm going to give you another example where some of you have actually done this and you didn't realize it. Some of you are not quitters. And you run up against a problem and you stick with it. And you just keep telling yourself, man, you know, there's an answer to this. I just have to figure it out. You know, sometimes it comes in a video game where you're looking for something, but the best ones are in real life. But you sit around the office, you sit around your house, wherever this moment's occurring, and maybe you're with other people. That's often the case. But I will tell you, as a screenwriter, this is one of the things you will end up doing dozens and dozens of times per script. You have to figure out why a character is doing something, why they would be there. And so you come up with plot mechanisms, and then, you know, there's always an answer fairly quickly as a writer, but it's usually the shitty answer. You know, it's usually like the part where people will point at the screen and go, oh, that was a horrible scene. You know, God, just this little flick of a switch, deus machina gets installed. But to really make things beautiful and natural and flow, you have to do your homework. Well, a lot of times you're trying to solve an engineering problem of some sort, and you just sit and you just think. You know, repetition through manufacturing processes is where a lot of people actually see the epiphany. Someone will be in an assembly line like Laverne and Shirley, and they're looking at, you know, soda pop bottles going by, and they just watch the process. They're seeing the intellect of someone else who designed this, you know, the press machine, you know, and then there's this other machine that does this and that. And they just sit there and look at it, and they see it every single day for months, maybe years, and they go, that could be one machine. You know, that could be one machine. You see these people on the internet who are super fast at their job. They have physical jobs where they're putting something in a bag or they're preparing food or whatever. And they do it extremely fast. And they actually do it, and sometimes it's sensationalized up with a bunch of extra moves that don't need to occur. But a lot of times they just do it faster than everyone else because they've done it so much and for so long, they trim the seconds off. It's incredible. The reason why I give you these examples is that you may have already done this several times. I honestly believe if you're at least 25, 30 years old, you've had at least one of these, and you've had it in a very powerful way. Now, we also have to be careful, right? There's nothing worse than becoming your own authenticator, right? You think of something and you authenticate it as true. It's amazing. You know, I've got folks that comment on the videos, and they put out some great, really thoughtful things. And you know, at the moment that they put these really thoughtful comments in and they really think things through and they're being just very scientific in return, and just a couple of them do this. And then, you know, in the next comment, they speak like they've given over the keyboard to somebody who's still trying to master the English language. And, you know, it's, you know, what a fucking idiot I am for having an opinion different than theirs. It's just sort of phenomenal. You sit there and you go, really? You know, you're the same person. So when you're thinking of things, again, truth predicts the future. And when it comes to invention, you could translate that as truth works and lies don't, or the wrong answer doesn't. I shouldn't say lies, but it's the other thing you have to remember is there's sometimes multiple ways of doing the same exact thing. I saw a special, little video on YouTube the other day, and it was this Japanese talk show or game show or something where one of the people involved with the show brought this little trick, and it was essentially a post with some steel loops and a rope and a ball on one end of the of this puzzle, and you had to move the ball to the other side of the puzzle. And he kept taking it all over the place to try to get people to figure it out. He even took it to a scientist who kept trying. In fact, the scientist tried a couple things and then literally tried to cheat. He tried to take the thing apart and slip it across the other side because he couldn't deal with, you know, I guess not being able to solve the problem. And finally, after maybe like 15, 20 minutes, they get it to a magician. And the magician just pulls the rope a couple different ways and boom, the ball's on the other side. No problem. And that's that thing, you know, where you have that epiphany of how things can be done differently. And it's a wonderful feeling when you have it, which is why even when those puzzles make you very frustrated, the second that you solve it, the sense of accomplishment and the sense of, I think, truth that you have discovered to get the accomplishment feels amazing. We have something called the gut feeling, right? Asians of the world, they believe very strongly in the gut. They constantly will ask you, how's your gut feel? And I love that because they have really figured out and not allowed themselves to be polluted away from something that I think is very powerful and real, which is your gut feeling. And the gut is on the spinal cord. The chakras that go up and down your spinal cord from your from your lower back to the inside of the back of your brain. It's interesting that perhaps, you know, one of your chakras is actually resonating into your gut. And your gut's just a big, you know, bagpipe. And it's just sitting there taking in the signal. You know, it's not really your stomach necessarily, but it's your guts, all of your intestines, right? Big receiver. There's a weird feeling when we contemplate deceiving someone, even if it's just for fun. You know, if a kid really pushes on Christmas Eve about Santa Claus coming and all this other stuff, and you know that you're going to do that after they go to bed, there's a weird feeling you have about, well, I'm lying to this child. I'm deceiving them. But boy, tomorrow it'll all pay off and they'll realize, you know, that the lie was actually true, right? A guy's actually coming to eat cookies and drop presents. How bizarre is our reality these days? I think truth feels good. I think lies feel acidic. And I think it can get into a really nasty situation if one's feeling like they've been had by someone, you know? So I think that's about it for this particular realm. I've been wanting to get this out for months and months and months just to start the conversation and start the thought process, because I think a lot of you are neck deep in this. The one recommendation I would make is to say, remember that when you ask for truth for you personally, that truth does not necessarily apply to anyone else in the world. Just be aware of that. That's hard to imagine because, you know, again, if you eat strawberries and it makes you super happy, and you tell your friend, hey, you should eat some strawberries and make you very happy, and they eat them and they realize that they're allergic to them and they're having anaphylactic shock and they're trying not to die. You know, just know that applies to all things. You are your own person. Your children are different than you. Your spouse is different than you. The best discoveries would work for all people. But we're not sure, right? We're not sure who has the solutions for each other, right? I know you feel me. I'm going to move on. It's deepthoughtsradio.com, facebook.com/deepthoughtsradio/. If you go to deepthoughtsradio.com, you can get all the feeds, YouTube, the podcast, Facebook. Subscribe if you dig the series. Like if you dig this episode. I understand it's a variety show. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.